Next is in the matter of East Bay Drywall versus the New Jersey Department of Labor. Counsel could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Christopher J. Hamner, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the New Jersey Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Morning, Chief Justice. Ravi Sadaraju of Sadaraju and Tharney, on behalf of Amicus, the National Employment Lawyers Association in New Jersey.
May it please the court, Jennifer Barr with Cooper Levinson, on behalf of the respondent, East Bay Drywall.
Morning, Your Honors. Jeffrey Jacobson, Fagery Drinker, on behalf of Amicus, New Jersey Civil Justice Institute.
Welcome, counsel. Please be seated, everyone. Mr. Hamner, please go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. If I could reserve 4 minutes again for rebuttal, that would be, if necessary. May I? May it please the court. The appellate division erred in its application of prongs C and B of the ABC test in reversing the commissioner's finding that the drywall installers for East Bay were not independent contractors. Indeed, in misapplying prong C of the ABC test, the appellate division ignored years-long precedent established by this court, leaving the state, employers, and workers with conflicting judicial guidance. It is important to remember that the employer bears the burden of establishing that the workers are, in fact, legitimately independent contractors for purposes of prong C. This is done by an examination of the factors commonly associated with a business to determine whether a worker actually has an ongoing business concern that is stable and lasting and can survive the end of the immediate relationship. Here, some of the workers presented insurance certificates to East Bay to demonstrate their independent business status and nothing else. The department attempted to ascertain additional evidence they were legitimate businesses, but could not. The court found that possession of such insurance certificates were significant, but not dispositive indicia of independent business status, but then found that it was sufficient, despite the lack of any other evidence. In doing so, the appellate division, for all intents and purposes, held that a worker who simply forms a single-member business entity and possesses a certificate of insurance can automatically establish independent contractor status. This holding flies in the face of corporate remnant. It's an easy matter to buy insurance, even for a non-existent business enterprise. The court incorrectly lowered the threshold of factors needed to establish independent contractor status. The court indicated it did not want to endorse the use of sham corporations or LLCs to avoid UCL contributions, but that is exactly the effect this ruling will have. The commissioner specifically addressed two alleged companies as representative samples, and the rest were exactly the same as to the relevant characteristics. The court agreed as to these two workers, but reversed as to the rest, because they were not, each was not individually discussed in detail. This was error, as none had any other evidence of business status aside from the insurance certificates. The court misstated this as a gap in the analysis and as a conflict with the ALJ's fact finding, but it was not. The commissioner made no new findings of fact. He merely ruled that the ALJ erroneously applied the facts to the prong C analysis. As to prong B, this factor requires that the employer demonstrate that the workers perform services either outside the usual course of the business for which such service is performed, or that such service is outside all of the places of business of the enterprise for which such service is performed. This court has defined the phrase all places of business to include not only where the company maintains a physical location, but also where it conducts an integral part of its business. It's undisputed that East Bay's business is the installation of drywall. The court erroneously applied the places of business analysis in carpet remnant, finding that the places where drywall were installed or outside of all other places of East Bay's business. Carpet Remnant's core business was selling carpet. East Bay's core business is the installation of drywall. That installation necessarily takes place at building sites, and nothing in the record indicates that East Bay even maintained a physical location. Applying the finding in Carpet Remnant as if the facts are in any way similar is clear error. Misclassification of workers as independent contractors frustrates the remedial purpose of the UCL by not only adversely affecting the Employment Trust Fund, but most importantly, rendering the misclassified workers ineligible for unemployment and disability benefits.
Are you concluded with your opening statement?
I have.
In a case like this, should the factors in Carpet Remnant be considered?
They should. They should.
Was that done here?
I'm sorry?
Was that done here?
It was not done here. It was not done here by the Appellate Division. The Appellate Division was satisfied that they had insurance certificates. That is not necessarily characteristic of an ongoing legitimate business. This harkens back to...
Was it done at the agency level or by the ALJ?
It was in the OAL, the auditor testified as to the lack of any other business indicia. In fact, the auditor went above and beyond. It is the employer's burden to establish these things. East Bay did not establish any other factors such as how much these alleged companies earn outside, whether they have other contracts, whether they have their own employees. There was no comparison or any indication that they earned money anywhere else. And there's nothing to indicate that there would have been an ongoing business concern. Look at in Gilchrist in 1957, this court said one of the key factors is whether a purported business can survive beyond the immediate relationship. And none of that evidence is here.
Should this court state that the Carpet Remnant factors are to be considered in these sorts of cases going forward?
They should be considered. Yes, this court should consider the Carpet Remnant factors. It's not an exhaustive list. Carpet Remnant factors are there that demonstrate what is characteristic of a legitimate ongoing business.
So let's take that for a second. I'm trying to think of the burden on the employer. In this case, the auditor found that half of the people working on these drywalls were independent contractors. And then it concentrated on the 16 that are before us, correct?
Correct.
So I'm looking at the C factors in Carpet Remnant, like duration and strength of each subcontractor's business, the number of his customers, the number of his employees, the extent of its resources. And then you also said whether or not it's going to be able to exist, you know, after its employment with East Bay. I'm trying to figure out, like, how is an employer supposed to know that in advance? It may have like dozens of subcontractors. We know that 16 were considered independent. Like, what sort of examination is the employer supposed to do in order to figure out whether or not the subcontractor, which is, let's say, an LLC, is going to survive after it's done a couple of drywall projects for East Bay?
Well,
look, you following me?
Well, that would be something, you know, it's the employer's burden to ask. It's the employer's burden to investigate this before they decide how they're going to treat a particular worker. In this case, the owner said, yeah, I checked for insurance certificates and I was satisfied with that. Nothing else.
I know, but one of the factors, you mentioned it, was, are they going to have, like, a business after East Bay? And let's say they're LLC. Like, what is the employer supposed to do? And I'm trying to figure out if they've got 20 different subs. Are they supposed to interrogate them? Tell me, what is their obligation?
Well, first, we don't concede their subs. They're just workers. They hired them to do this particular job. the employer here was familiar with, it's all word of mouth within the industry, within the construction industry. He called other contractors, have you used this person, have you used that person, do you know someone who can work for me, who I can hire for this particular project? It is the employer's burden. That's how the legislature has structured this statute.
I understand that it's the employer's burden, that's clear, but I'm trying to figure out, like, how much, like, what is that burden? And that's why I was asking that question, is in terms of, like, how far are they supposed to interrogate the person who may be coming with some sort of corporate clothing, like an LLC?
The employer's responsibility to determine whether this person actually has a business. How they do that, who they ask, what they check into, that's not something that can be spelled out specifically by the court.
At the end of the year, the employer would know if this individual worked for 10 weeks or for 45 weeks, which could inform the decision, no?
Perhaps. It's difficult to say. Different industries may work in different ways. A particular worker maybe worked for them for 45 weeks and for someone else for 15 weeks or anything. Unemployment contributions, I mean, unemployment benefits are based upon base weeks of employment. It doesn't have to be with the same employer. It can be with several employers. And in the aggregate, whether they're responsible or whether they're eligible for benefits based upon total weeks of employment within a particular period of time.
Did East Bay have a physical site? Do we know whether they had a building, a lot, equipment?
The record doesn't contain any information that they had a physical location.
How do courts apply prong B in the era that we're in today, where much work can be done remotely and where there may not even be a physical site for administrative work in a business of this kind?
Department of Labor recognizes that, but this is the way the statute is written. Whether to modify the statute to account for such situations would be a policy decision on the part of the legislature. It's their role to modify it or add exceptions as needed, and they have not done so.
So the statute is what it is, as you point out. How does the department recognize it, and what does it do in this situation?
Well, like in this situation, they looked at what the core business is. What does East Bay do? They install drywall. Where does that take place? It takes place at construction sites. It takes place in these residences.
Yeah, at least in Carpet Remnant, there was a warehouse and also retail stores. Go ahead.
Yes, Carpet Remnant warehouse had two retail locations.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out, in this case, should there have been established on the record what physical site East Bay had?
There's nothing in the record that indicates that they even had a physical location at all.
So that would seem to be problematic for purposes of the analysis.
Not at all.
I guess your argument is they'd have to show that. The burden is on them. And if they're not showing that, then the place of business is at each drywall construction site.
Where the core of their integral part of their business, where that takes place.
Okay.
And that's
Did they provide the department with a business address?
I don't believe so. And I want to note, I'm glad you brought that up, Justice, because as far as business addresses, telephone numbers, internet presence, none of these workers had that either.
I'm talking about the workers, the East Bay. Did they, on forms that they filled out, was there an address?
I don't think that's in the record.
So your position is, second part of B, such services performed outside of all the places of business of the enterprise, they haven't established that they have any place outside of each construction site.
Right. And this court said in Carpet Remnant that means where an integral part of their business takes place.
Let's assume that's true, that they don't have a business site and that every location where they're doing drywall is a place of business for them. That's only one of the factors, correct?
In the B prong.
In B. That's one of the.
B prong is disjunctive. One can either, you know, either or. There are two choices in the B prong.
So let's assume that's the case. That means B is out of the picture. They're employees. No, not necessarily employees, right? You still have to go to C.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You'd still have to do a C analysis,
yes,
correct?
They must meet each and every part of that ABC test.
Okay, so with respect to C, coming back to what Justice Albin said, if all they have is the information that they needed to write a check at the end of every week for these individuals, how are they supposed to show that they were going concerns, that they were doing work for others? If all the information they have was enough to fill out the 1099, what are they supposed to show and how are they supposed to show it? And I guess, lastly, is what they showed enough here if that's all that exists?
What they showed was not enough. All they have were insurance certificates. And the owner
even
of
if
East
there's,
Bay.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, finish, please.
The owner of East Bay said he checked. He asked them for insurance certificates. I mean, well, you know, the concern is that this would lead to abuse. There's nothing preventing, with this holding, there's nothing preventing an employer from saying, I'll hire you, but first you have to go online, spend a few dollars, become an LLC, and buy an insurance certificate, then I'll hire you.
So essentially the fact that they could ask them if they had an insurance certificate and provide that, but did not ask and cannot provide anything other than that, is on its face insufficient.
Yes.
Tell me if I'm mistaken. I want to be clear about this. The employer has the burden of establishing all three prongs, A, B, and C.
Yes.
So if it failed in B, it's over. They're employees. You don't go to C then.
That is correct.
Okay.
That's how the statute is structured. And I do want to note that this is not new. The ABC test, current iteration of the ABC test, is word for word identical to that of Chapter 312 of the laws of 1938. So this is not something that's, you know, suddenly sprung upon the state or sprung upon the world, or employers wouldn't know this.
So if this is hypothetically, if the work site were the construction site, that's the only site.
Yes.
They're employees. From your perspective.
Yes.
Don't look at A, don't look at C.
That's correct. Whether that should be modified is up to the legislature, and it hasn't.
Do regulations govern any of this?
Well, the regulations are derived from the statute.
Right, but I mean, the statute's pretty bare bones in terms of B. Such services performed outside of all the places of business of the enterprise for which such service is performed. Do regulations drill into that, as sometimes they do?
There aren't any present regulations that address the ABC test.
The reason I say that is because you're saying the legislature would be the one to respond to current conditions where perhaps businesses don't have offices so often in the traditional sense. But this is a very, you know, skeleton kind of statute. I'm just wondering if perhaps the place to do that might be in a regulation.
Well, there presently aren't any regulations.
There are no regulations.
I want to follow up on your answer to Justice Albin's question. If the work site is the place of business, you can't prevail under B, and therefore you're an employee, correct?
It's possible that you can't prevail, correct.
So that would then sweep in an individual who did one or two or three installations over the course of 365 days and derived most of that individual's income from jobs for others. That person would be considered an employee under your analysis?
For this particular project, for this particular company,
yes. For this company?
Yes.
And just so that I understand, even if it's a very small fraction of their overall income and of their overall work, they would still be an employee of East Bay.
That's correct.
It would also mean that the Department of Labor erred in its determination that the 16 other companies, other half, were independent. They should have been all designated as employees.
Not necessarily. We don't know the facts. We don't know who they are. We don't know that because they were not in dispute, those facts were not brought forward in the OAL.
But they'd be working at the locations, and you're saying that that's the ball game. If they're working at the locations and there is no place of business on the record.
We don't know what they were doing. Perhaps East Bay needed an electrician for some reason. We don't know what they were doing. Those facts weren't developed. They weren't in dispute.
Did the Department of Labor look at those LLCs and individuals?
The initial auditor, we don't know if they were LLCs. We don't know anything about them. The auditor looked at this, found that several of them were, in fact, independent businesses. We don't know what business they were in. We don't know what they did on site, off site. We have no information about it because they were not in dispute.
Let me follow up on some of the questioning about the prong B issue that you raised. Let's say there's an LLC that has 30 employees and sends them out to different jobs, okay? They send them out to East Bay's job on Maple Street, somebody's house. East Bay doesn't have an office. It works only at the locations where they've been asked to install drywall. Are those employees of that LLC that has 30 employees that it's dispatching to these different jobs employees of East Bay simply because they're working in the home?
It's a fact-specific inquiry. If one of these
understand. But what you're asking us to rule is that it's the ball game as soon as it's established that they're working in these homes.
With this set of facts, if East Bay wasn't in the installation business, say East Bay was a general okay. contractor, and they hired another company like East Bay, who had employees, and they have 30 employees and three are on the
use these facts. Okay, you're saying East, and my hypothetical would be a drywall installation company, which doesn't have the staffing to get the job done, hires from someone who has 30 employees, pays that company for their time, and you would say that they become employees for purposes of the UCL because they're working in the homes that are, in fact, the place of business of East Bay. Is that what your position would be?
It's possible for a worker to be an employee somewhere, but for East Bay, they're an employee for purposes of this, using these facts.
So the worker could be getting unemployment through the LLC that I, in my hypothetical, with 30 employees, and then the UCL is also triggered because they go out for 2 weeks and work in a house and install the drywall, or I don't know how long it takes.
Well, these
3 days.
These workers were paid directly.
No, I understand. But do you see what I'm saying? Is that by saying, by...
I think the facts are not the same. I think that if they're paid directly by East Bay, they're working for East Bay.
So
even
but
though
you're, are you are,
somewhere else.
Are you asking this court, and this obviously affects small businesses, potentially, in a very competitive market, are you asking this court to find that for purposes of prong B, if there is no office... And the locations where the small business operates are in those residential locations, that whatever happens in terms of their bringing somebody in, they're paying the unemployment.
If they are paying a worker directly, and they have no physical location, and the integral part of their business takes place at a remote site, then those working at that remote site who are paid directly by East Bay shall be considered employees.
So is there a distinction between them paying an LLC that has a bunch of employees and them paying an LLC that consists of one person?
A single person LLC is an entity separate from the individual. I mean, it's not separate from the individual. It's an individual. It's paid as an individual.
But
is nothing to stop a company from hiring another company, having contract with that company, paying that company billing East Bay, and paying that company to provide workers.
I don't see the distinction, frankly, and tell me what I'm missing here between, let's say an LLC has two members, and one member goes out to one employee who's a member of that LLC goes out to to do the work, and somebody is, the other person's on another job. And you would say that they're going to that that residential location, and that's all B is set, is they can't satisfy as soon as they're working there, whether that's a two-member LLC or a one-member LLC or perhaps more. What would, under your analysis, that's the location is the end of it?
Location, that's where they conduct an integral part of their business. If they're paying this worker directly, that's an employee under this analysis, under this set of facts and this particular statute.
Okay, and that's true if there's a two-member LLC.
If one is paid directly by East Bay, yeah.
So there, how about we go to 10? How about if there are 10 employees to that LLC? The LLC gets paid for their time. The members of the LLC share in that.
The LLC gets paid directly?
The LLC.
Well, that would be a subcontract.
Well, these people are LLCs.
Well, they're single-member LLCs. The single-member LLCs, and they were paid directly by East Bay. They were issued 1099s. They weren't issued, they weren't paid as a business. They were issued 1099s.
Is it your position? I'm trying to understand it in response to the questions and answers between you and Justice Patterson, that the corporate status is immaterial, provided that the worker is paid directly by East Bay. I'll call East Bay the general contractor. Is that your position? So it would make a difference if it's a one-person LLC or 10 people are in it. If the worker is paid directly by East Bay, that's the way the analysis goes, and the corporate barrier is immaterial. Is that your position?
For a single person LLC, they're being paid as a single person. Right now, there's no indication that East Bay subcontracted with anybody. We don't know if the others that were considered independent businesses, we don't know their status. That record wasn't developed. Here we have particular individuals working on particular projects, and they are paid directly by East Bay. I would like to note that for a couple of them, prior to 2013, they treated them as employees and paid them with a W-2 rather than a 1099. And there was no articulation of why that changed by the time of the audit.
Counsel, can I ask you, is part of your argument based on the Appellate Division's application of the standard that to be applied to decisions of administrative agencies in the area of expertise that they have, that the Appellate Division did not properly apply that standard of review?
That's correct. The agency is owed some deference, especially in this situation.
I'm sorry, if you could pick up your voice a little bit.
I said the agency is owed some deference, especially when they're talking about the areas within their purview, as here. One of the major errors that the Appellate Division said, just because the commissioner did not list each and every single one that they didn't find in his favor, even though the two that they agreed with have the same exact characteristics and no more indicia of an independent ongoing business as any of the others. It begs the question of what is the commissioner supposed to do if there's 100? Is he supposed to list each and every one and say, number two, same as number one, number three, the same? You know, it appears that the Appellate Division, the only reason they, when they agreed with two, and they have the same characteristics as the others, the same relevant characteristics, it's error to find that the rest of them don't also fall within the commissioner's decision. That, you know, they just found that, you know, they met prong C only because the commissioner didn't list them. But the commissioner specifically said, they have the same characteristics. Not one of them has any more indicators of being an independent business than the two that the court agreed with.
What did the commissioner find on B?
On B?
Yep.
The commissioner found that the places of business are where the construction actually takes place.
We're not. So they found that the employer had satisfied B or not satisfied?
Did not satisfy B.
So the commissioner found that neither B nor C were satisfied.
Going to the commissioner's decision, described the under part A, what the commissioner found were the activities for East Bay. And it says that, as observed by respondent, the testimony of Benjamin Descala, a managing member of East Bay, reveals that East Bay bid on, negotiated for, and acquired all of the work performed for the drywall subcontractors. The amount paid by East Bay to the drywall subcontractors was a fixed amount set by East Bay and not negotiated with the drywall subcontractor. East Bay provided all the materials for the job, such as sheetrock, screws, nails, corner head, corner bead, spackle, level lines. In other words, the people that were doing the actual work at the work site were performing as employees of East Bay in all respects, because they were given the materials and they were asked to perform the work needed to make those materials to carry out the contractual obligation that East Bay had with the GC, with the general contractor. Am I correct on that?
Yes, because they had the workers had no connection whatsoever with the builder. Any complaints went to East Bay. East Bay told them what they had to do. And
by considering these people subcontractors, that avoids East Bay from having to pay unemployment compensation insurance.
Not only that, that is correct. And not only that, these workers would later on be ineligible for unemployment and disability insurance.
Because they're considered subcontractors,
correct,
not employees.
Correct.
And that undermines precisely what the public policy behind the statute.
It frustrates remedial nature of the unemployment compensation law, and that's the problem with misclassification today, and it's a large issue for the Department of Labor. This enables an employer to shirk their responsibilities to provide their payments for disability and unemployment insurance. So the question is, the problem is not only how it affects the fund, but more importantly, how it affects the worker later on, making them ineligible for these benefits.
And so the presumption is, under the law, you're an employee, and the employer has to prove otherwise.
Yes.
Anything you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, Your Honor. I just want to reserve time later for rebuttal if necessary.
Yes. All right. Mr. Sadarajan, please.
Chief Justices, thank you very much. On behalf of the National Employment Lawyers Association of New Jersey, it's an honor to appear before you, and we're very grateful for the opportunity. This issue of worker misclassification is a very serious issue in New Jersey and across the country. In our papers, we cited Governor Murphy's 2019 report. While this case involves the unemployment, the UCL, this misclassification test is the same for the wage payment law and the New Jersey wage and hour law. And the result of this case could have dramatic impact for tens of thousands of workers who could be stripped of their rights under these statutes. The wage and hour law and the wage payment law are remedial statutes that must be interpreted liberally in order to achieve their purpose. When we're talking about whether someone is an independent contractor, the question we're really asking is, do they receive the benefits of the wage and hour law and the wage payment law? That means, do they get overtime after they work 40 hours a week? That means, are they subject to illegal deductions from their pay? For example, can they be made to pay for their own equipment? Can they be made to pay for any damage that happens? And these are all protections where the answer would be no if they were employees. Once they lose those protections, because they're quote-unquote independent contractors, they don't have any of those protections. So,
give us a scenario in which, and knowing as you do, I assume you're familiar with, just based on this record, with East Bay's business model, which is installation of drywall in residences. How could East Bay set that business model up to ensure that it was working only with independent contractors?
Well, what I'll say is, if you look at the definition of to employ under the wage and hour law, the definition of employee is to suffer or permit work. That's a very broad, and when this court addressed the Hargrove case, it noted that was the broadest definition that you could have under the law. So right now, when East Bay brings in people to do drywall, they're suffering or permitting work. People are working for them.
So do I interpret from your answer that there is no way that this could this business model where they get people to install, somehow procure employees qualified and skilled in installation of drywall, and those people do the work, that can't be done other than through employment?
If people, what I would say is that if they meet the standard under the ABC test, which is purposely a high standard, then they may
be going in circles at this point. How would, because you obviously have a lot of expertise in this area, how could someone, a small business that wants to install drywall but doesn't have 25 employees in their who they hire as full-time employees and is responding to the need for the jobs that come and go, and in a construction business that obviously has ups and downs, are you saying they cannot do that business without having everybody who comes and works for them for 2 weeks or 3 weeks be considered employees?
Well, if I could answer your question, because I see the practical element of how this works. If someone comes in for a day and you're not, I think the concern is, well, if these people aren't working full time and they're only working one day a week or 2 days a week, or they're working 3 days in 1 month and a week in another month, there's nothing wrong with getting the paperwork for those people for that period of time saying, all right, you're employed. If they're calling in an agency or they're calling into a shop saying, we need workers for this day, it's easy to say that, all right, for that period, you'll be working. And then what happens is you are protected by the wage payment law, the wage and hour law, and you pay into unemployment.
And so the person works for them for 3 days and then they're collecting unemployment because there's no job the next week?
I'm Justice, to be candid with you, the standard for if whether you work for 3 days, whether you get unemployment, I don't believe you'd be eligible for unemployment after only 3 days. So I in that case, I don't know
the answer to that.
But you read Section B the way Mr. Hammer does, or do you read it differently?
I read it a little bit differently because it says or. So if you meet the first part of B, you meet B. It doesn't say you have to meet both parts.
But with regard to the second part, if Joe Smith LLC works for different installing companies throughout the year, and only works for East Bay one day a month, is that LLC considered an employee of East Bay? I hope I've said that right.
I had a little bit of trouble following it, but you're saying that as I understood the question, if you work for multiple places during the year or during a month,
yes.
If you're working for multiple places, there are people who get multiple W-2s at the end of the year for how much they worked at a given place.
So you read it as Mr. Hamner does. If you've worked for them once or twice or only 10 times for the entirety of the year, you're treated as an employee for those limited jobs that you completed.
If you meet the standard, the facts you're giving me aren't, you'd have to apply them to the ABC test, because if you're performing the services, if you're talking about the second prong, is it performed outside all the places of the business of the enterprise? I think that's the part it seems like we're struggling with. There's consequence to both sides. Because right now, if you say, well, we're just going to limit to the four corners of an office, that's going to lead to widespread abuse. And that's what we're concerned about at Neyland, New Jersey.
But if the work site is the office, then the answer to the question is yes?
If the work site is the office, if the work site is, with the way the cases have come down in New Jersey, the way the state courts, the federal courts, and cases across the country have come down on this, they've all been pretty clear that if you're working out of a place, and if East Bay Drywall works out of their house or they have a Regis space or whatever it is, and they're there and they're assigning people to go out into the world to represent their interests and to do an assignment, then that's part of what the employer does. I handle a lot of truck driver cases, and you have cases where people show up to a warehouse in the morning. They're given a list of places to go, and they're told, here's the times you have to get here by. You need to call us during the day. And then they spend an hour or 2 hours loading their truck, getting their instructions, and then they go out they go out to make their deliveries.
And if for whatever reason that truck driver chooses to work for you one day a month and has many others for whom the person works on the other days, they're an employee for those 12 days?
There are plenty, Your Honor, in union halls, people, yes, the answer would be yes, because in union halls and other places, this happens, where people come in, they're told, hey, we need you today, you come in, and then for that day, instead of getting a 1099, you get a W-2. Now, candidly, I don't see a lot of times where someone's only working one day a month in that kind of setting. People are usually there, and this is where the abuse happens. This is what we're seeing in the cases, and this is why I want to bring it up to you, because this is the consequence of what's happening here, where you misclassify somebody. The problem isn't when someone works one day a month, it's when they're working 75 hours a week, and they're not getting any overtime, and their employers or their non-employers.
Do you see the issue that we have here? Because if this stands or falls under B, and locations, there is no distinction between the person who's there and the chief's hypothetical one day a month, and somebody who works, 7 days a week.
But I think in terms of I think it's perhaps an error to focus on the frequency of how often they're coming into work, as opposed to what they're doing when they're working. So my daughter just got a job this last weekend, and until school ends, she's working one day a week. So that happens to be what her schedule is. For that one day when she's there, she's an employee. So if you're...
I don't want to discuss your daughters. I understand it's on your mind, but I mean, realistically, you could have somebody working for 50 different contractors in an area in which there's a lot of construction. The person could be in the course of a year working for 50 different contractors, technically, right? And they are and what you're asking the Attorney General and you are asking the court to do is to essentially say that there's no floor to this. They're employees of just of everybody, every contractor they work for. You see the issue.
I do see the issue, and I do see what you're struggling with. But I think the consequence of what you're saying is, then these people will be employed. We have two alternatives here. They get a 1099 or they get a W-2.
What I'm saying is forget what consequences of what I'm saying. I'm asking a question.
Yeah.
And trying to ask you to help us as amicus with what I think is a test that is being urged on us based on location of places that really kind of create the subcontractor, unless it's a big business, no longer is an independent contractor under this scenario.
Well, under the wage, this term subcontractor, under the Wage Theft Act that was just passed, if there's joint and several liability for violations if you provide labor to someone. So that distinction isn't as important in the law anymore, given what the Wage Theft Act says about them being joint and severally liable.
Right, but we're talking here about the unemployment compensation law.
Correct.
Right. So you could have somebody having 50 employers in the course of a year. Is that really what the legislature was thinking?
I don't know if the legislature was thinking about 50 different employers. I think what the legislature was thinking is, if under the law, if you're providing services somewhere, you receive certain protections, and those protections come because we want you to be considered an employee because you're considered. You receive certain protections under the law. So for your example, when someone works one day a week, during that one day a week, there's a lot of abuse that can happen.
I guess we can't engage in sweeping generalization. We shouldn't. Because the example that you gave, someone working out of a union hall, if they went to 50 different places, they would have employment in 50 different, they're not an independent contractor.
Correct.
People who are working out of a union hall.
Correct.
That doesn't necessarily sweep into this. Now, I got a question about B. Did you say that there's light between you and your co-counsel on B?
I don't know that there's light between us. I just wanted to...
Does the employer have to satisfy B both parts of B in
no,
order?
No, he doesn't. It's or.
So you're telling me if the employer satisfies the first part of B, we don't go to the second part of B?
Correct.
Okay, so satisfy such services is either outside the usual course of the business for which such service is performed.
Correct.
So let's look at that piece of it right there.
Correct.
The service performed was East Bay does drywall. They called these people in to do drywall. So that's not outside the usual course of the business, correct?
Correct.
So the employer has satisfied B there?
So they don't satisfy the first prong of B. So in order to satisfy B, they have to...
They don't satisfy... No, I'm looking at the first prong of B. Such service is either outside the usual course of the business...
Yes.
For which such service is performed. That's the first prong?
That's the first half of B, yes.
Okay. And you're saying if the employer satisfies that, I don't look at the next, or such service is performed outside of all places of business?
Correct.
So let's just look at the first part of it then. Such service is either outside the usual course of the business for which service is performed. So... Okay, so it's not as, okay, so the first, so let's take me through that. Analyze that piece for me under the facts of this case.
Under the facts of this case, this is a drywall business, and they've hired people to install the drywall, and so the service they're providing is not outside the usual course of their business.
Okay. And that's why you have to look at the second prong.
And right. Then in order for them to meet B, they need to look at the second prong, which is... It's provided outside of all places of business.
How does that apply to a general contractor? Someone's building a house, right? They get subs, and I know that's a loaded term in this particular context. I don't mean to suggest that that ends the inquiry, but they get somebody to do the plumbing, the electricity, the drywall, the all the different functions. They hire someone to be performing. Because that general contractor's in the business of construction, can they satisfy the first prong of Part B?
If you would,
do you see what I'm getting at here?
I do, but like, can I just clarify what I? If you're hiring one person to come in to do the drywall,
right?
That person, you need to call them a sub. If you're coming in with a company, and the employees of that company are coming in, you have 20 people coming in. Employed by Joe's Plumbing to do the plumbing work on a building, then those people, and the law is pretty clear on this, the sub has an obligation to pay those people properly. And under the Wage Theft Act, if they're performing services at your location.
But is the usual course of business for which such service is performed for that general contractor who's building a house, is that construction? And if so, aren't all those people, the plumber, the electrician, all of these people, potentially, the first part of Part B is satisfied immediately? It's all construction.
Justice, there's two. I want to answer your question, but there's two different scenarios in which to answer it. Okay. If you're doing a small addition and you bring in a guy and you're saying, all right, you're going to come in to do this work, then. Then that person, and you're directly paying him, then you need to meet the obligations if you're going to call that person an independent contractor. Or you need to meet A, B, and C. However, if you're retaining a company called, you know, with numerous plumbers and they're sending people in, then the sub who pays them has to meet their obligations under the law as employees. And under the Wage Theft Act, there's joint and several liability if they're performing services at their site.
Somebody has an addition done on their house, or has drywall installed in their house. There's no contractor, and they're not hiring a contractor. They hire a drywall person, right? They hire an LLC, Joe Smith LLC, for doing drywall. Could the homeowner be responsible for unemployment compensation?
No, because it's not outside the usual course. If I hire someone to paint my house.
Okay, so you're saying that would be the distinction. But the general contractor who's going to hire a plumber for a couple days, they've got, under this interpretation, Part B, Part 1 of B is already met, right?
Well, a lot of it would depend on the facts of how often they use that service, but it would depend on the nature of the relationship between the entities, I would say. I think that's what's the more.
They go out there and they say, I need a plumber. I'm building a house. Part of my construction project is I need plumbing to be installed. I need a plumber. I get a plumber. You're saying that's all part of the same business, the ordinary course of business. The first part of B is met or can't be met by the employer, right?
Look, these cases are very fact sensitive. If you have a general contractor who says that their job is to oversee a job and that they don't provide the plumbing services, I could see a scenario where they could say, I don't do plumbing, and so that's outside of what I do, and so I bring someone in to do that. So that would be, it would really depend on the nature of their business. In this case, they do drywall.
So as amicus, can you give us a principled statement of the law under Part B, which seems to be the focus here today, that would make the distinction that you think should be made?
I think what we're arguing as amicus is, when you look at the case, again, we're not in a bubble here. This isn't the only state or the only court that's addressing these issues. And I think it's important, you know, we laid out several pages of precedent where we're seeing what other states have done. And it's pretty clear, and this includes the federal court in New Jersey and cases in Massachusetts and California, what they're saying is if just because you're not in the four corners of their office, if you're going out and taking instruction and doing work on behalf of an employer, that doesn't mean you don't receive the protection under the second half of B. And I think that's the...
This is really fact-sensitive. I mean, because you throw in the facts of carpet remnant, and you have a completely different outcome, right?
The facts of carpet remnant are, as a plaintiff's lawyer, I would not take that case, because if you look at, they had their own business, they did multiple jobs, it's a little bit of a different scenario. The abuse we're concerned about is where you have the situation where you have individuals who are providing services, who are being abused, who aren't getting the work they need to get. That's the issue that becomes difficult. And when you look at all these cases and you see the factual record that is developed, is that they're doing work they're being directed to do work by their statutory employer, and the employer's trying to look for an escape hatch to say, well, you didn't do it in the four corners of my building. You know, you don't get the protection of the law.
Do we know, based on this record, the 16 people and entities involved, how many hours they worked for East Bay over the course of a year? Do we know?
I don't believe that's in the record. I didn't see that in the decision. And this was, it's...
Would that have been an important factor?
Well, I think it would give flavor to the court. If they're working 70 hours a week and they're not getting overtime, you're going to see why they, as my colleague pointed out, they switched them from being W-2s to 1099s.
And who has, and then the next question is, who has the burden of bringing forth this information?
The employer has the burden of establishing that these people aren't employees. The way the law is set up, you want the court, the law, the legislature wants people to presume that if you're providing services or an entity is suffering or permitting the work, and think about the language. They're permitting people to come in. That there's a presumption that they're going to be employees. And if they in order to overcome that, they have to meet a test that's going to be difficult. Now here, given that they're called independent contractors, these workers could have been subject to illegal deductions. They could have been subject to not getting overtime. And the public policy consequences of not getting overtime, you have people who are injured on the job. You have people who, you know, there's going to be a strain on the workers' compensation system.
Is overtime an issue in this case?
I'm sorry?
I just missed it. Is overtime an issue in this case?
No, but Justice Albin asked about what the consequences. I was trying to respond to his question.
I think we have your position.
I just have one question, because I think I didn't think I was confused, but now I may be, which is not unusual for me. I didn't think that B of the ABC test was really at issue, because in cases like this, remote work was not considered. Remote work satisfied B, I guess, that I didn't think B was an issue. That in most, I know there's not a lot of reported cases. I know there's not a lot of stuff out there, but that remote, that it's usually outside the usual. The remote work like this, where they don't have a site they go to report, check in, check out, satisfies B. Doesn't satisfy B.
It does, Your Honor, because we cited a lot of cases from across the country, the federal court in New Jersey, an appellate division case, and there's cases all over the country that have addressed this issue and have addressed B and have said that if you're performing work on behalf of an employer and if you're doing it at their direction outside of the workplace, outside of their office or outside of their location, that means that you're performing work. It's an extension of the workplace, is what they said.
The Department of Labor, the commissioner, generally holds, and I admit they're mostly unreported, there's very little to go on here, that remote work sites are not considered within all the places of the employer's business. And this would be a remote work site.
Justice, the way the case law has come down in New Jersey State, in unreported, in New Jersey Federal Court, Appellate Division, and cases across the country, this has been a big issue. They have come down on the position I'm advocating for. I'm saying this with a lot of support from what other courts have done. And what would happen in New Jersey is our workers would have far less protection.
Remote work sites are therefore within the places of the employer's business. Question, that's the end of the case here. C doesn't even get considered.
I think a way to approach it is, has the employer expressed an interest in what's happening at that location? I think that would be a fair test to say. So, for example.
Counsel, let me ask you this. A general contractor is seeking drywall performance. If I interrupt somebody, I beg your pardon.
No, you didn't interrupt me. I was apologizing to the chief for my one more question.
Oh, that the chief did say that. If a general contractor is looking for a drywall subcontractor to do the work, that they, I'm assuming that they have a network of people that they can call to see what to bid the job out. Once the job is awarded to that contractor to perform the drywall, then they have to bring in the people to do the work. If they don't have anyone to do the work, if they just hired individual other subcontractors who happen to be people one at a time, and they're not considered employees because each one of them can provide a certificate of insurance or whatever it is that they would bring to say they're not employees, they're subcontractors. What is the job of the subcontractor other than to hire other subcontractors? Well, if I make it myself clear.
I think I understand the question. The subcontractor hires people and they're doing work and they have to come in as employees. And this is a big issue in public sector, in public construction.
So, let me restate it so I know, so you understand what I'm asking you. If the only thing that East Bay does here is to hire subcontractors to do this, the drywall work, is that really a company that does drywall material, or is that just a place that seeks out other people to do the work?
I think that would fall under the latter suggestion you're describing.
And as far as you're concerned, is there any evidence in this record that East Bay actually has employees who do this work?
I think they, from what my colleague said, I believe they had. They did consider some people to be employees, and then they switched them over.
No, I understand that, but their position is here that all of the people here are not employees; they're all subcontractors. That's their position.
That's their position.
All right. Thank you. I understand.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
So, for 30 years. Employers have operated under the guidance of this court, the guidance that this court gave in Carpet Remnant. And it was clear guidance. Even though we have a skeleton, you know, statute and no regulations, this court was very clear in the guidance as far as the three prongs of the agency test. I'm actually going to start with part C. This court said that if the purpose is that if the subcontractor is independent of the person providing the service, here is East Bay, if it's an independent relationship such that if East Bay stops providing work, the contractor can continue on, right? That's the whole concept of an independent contractor, to avoid the situation where termination of that relationship would result in the person who's doing the work from joining the ranks of the unemployed. That's what we're talking about. That's the guidance from this court. Now, this court also, circling back to some of those specific considerations that this court indicated in Carpet Remnants, those were for the remand for Part C, and some of those guidance, some of those questions might be particularly relevant for a carpet installer. They're good, it's a good list to go by, but certainly not exhaustive. However, as far as Part B is concerned, I was actually sort of surprised that there were so many questions about Part B, because in my mind, it seems so obvious that there is no way in construction that we can consider all of the individual places, all the individual houses, as being part of the place of business of the contractor. And my client is, and I think that is a distinction. We're talking about construction. And even though we've had 30 years of this court's guidance in Carpet Remnants, construction has historically been operated by independent contractors. And it's an assumption that business, that you will need independent contractors, either the business, either the contracts, the individual projects, all of a sudden you have more than you can handle, or they might be in different locations. And so some of your go-to subcontractors might not be able to make it to that location. It could be a seasonal difference, especially we're talking about drywall at the shore, and that does reflect, you know, the work is reflected by the season. Part B, I mean, no general contractor would ever be able to consider its plumbers, drywalls, painters, cabinet installers to be independent subcontractors if all of those houses that they are building are not part of their place of business. So, or are part of their place of business. So I think we need to look at the record and with a very reasonable interpretation of what the industry is and what the possibilities are for this relationship. I think the reasonable minds have to prevail here. And on that note, the independent subcontractors here were not just showing up to work and getting slapped with a 1099. They sat at the computer at some point and created a business, and they called some insurers and got insurance. But more importantly, and this is something that has sort of been ignored up to this point, my client testified that he knew these independent contractors. He knew that they were working for other places. In fact, he would often call another contractor and say, who do you have that can put this drywall in? So the testimony of my client is, in addition to all the paper documents that we have in the record, is crucial to the conclusion that we hired independent contractors, that these were not employees. And it was the independent contractor's choice to be their own business. And my client also did testify that one of the former employees, I think it was Dan Martin, no, it's Sarah, I forget his first name, is Mr. Sarah, testified he had been an employee but wanted to kind of go out on his own. He wanted to, as we would call it as attorneys, hang out his own shingle and own his own business. And so he transitioned to an independent contractor status. So ultimately, we are requesting that this court affirm what the ALJ determined that we, you know, based on the evidence, including my client's testimony, that this was clearly in the construction industry, a situation where these contested entities were independent contractors.
May I ask you a question about prong B?
Yes, you may.
Carpet Remnants says that the phrase places of business for that prong refers only to locations where the enterprise has a physical plant or conducts an integral part of its business. What is your business?
We are in the drywall industry. It's a father and son business. We contact builders and we get the contracts. We figure out how much raw material will be needed, how much time is necessary to complete the job, and then we subcontract that out. So we are more like the brokers in trauma nurses, the employment agency. So we broker the we get the contract, and then we sub out the work.
You do the bidding.
Mm-hmm.
You do the spec. You look at the specs. You figure out how much material is needed.
Mm-hmm.
You submit a bid. You buy the materials. You arrange for the installation, and then you do the billing afterwards and collect the money.
Yes.
So that's more than simply subbing out for the installation. And regardless, isn't the installation integral to your work?
It is the end product of the work, but the majority of the work is in that that administrative element of this procedure. So looking at the specs, figuring out exactly what is needed.
And I don't see the comparison to trauma nurses, because I don't see the broker going out there to make certain that the nurse did the right job. And in the record in this case, your client would go out to the physical site to see whether or not the drywall was properly installed. And if it wasn't, then he would have it reinstalled, correct?
There is testimony that one of the members would meet with the drywallers to go over the specs. And then, from that point on, the subcontractors would take over.
When the project was done,
mm-hmm.
when the drywall was installed, did your client go out and look at it to make certain, yes, it's properly installed?
Yeah, I honestly don't know that specific phrase is in the record, but there was testimony that if it wasn't, then it would come back to my client. And my client would have to hire somebody else to fix it.
But you're saying that who made that determination that it wasn't? You're saying that your client wasn't the person who made the decision whether or not it was properly installed?
There's no testimony to that effect. I think it was if the builder went in and saw if it was a, you know, drywalling in new construction, if the builder determined it was not properly done, they would call
it. I want to be clear about the record. Are you saying there's nothing in the testimony to indicate that your client ever went out to the work site?
No, I mean, there is testimony that we went to the work site.
Why?
At the beginning.
What?
At the beginning to go over the specs with the subs.
The specs, okay. Mm-hmm. And the specs are to make certain that the drywall is properly installed, correct?
In the right rooms, in the right, you know.
Yeah, but now you're saying there's nothing in the record to indicate that your client went out at the end of the project to make certain that the specs were followed?
To be honest, there was nothing that said, you know, quote, and then I went out and would check to make sure it was done. The testimony is that if it wasn't done, it would be, if it wasn't done properly, according to the builder would reach out to my client.
We don't know, but you either went out or you waited for complaints and then responded.
Correct.
Either way, your client would not blindly accept the builder's complaint. They would go and check and determine in their own whether they comply with the contract, because their relationship with the builder is contractual.
Correct.
So they would say, well, I disagree with you. This is properly done. And the only way to do that is because they hired somebody else to do it. So even though they make they say they're some, they are drywallers, but they do, as you correctly noted, is their employment agency. They hire people to actually do the work.
Right. The word I used was brokers, but yeah, yes.
This isn't quite a brokerage relationship. I mean, the actual drywalls are presented by your client at the work site, correct?
The material?
Yeah.
Yes, correct.
And they go there and go over the specs with the people who are going to install it.
Correct.
This isn't like trauma nurses where the broker goes to the hospital and is going over the patient's condition and this is what I want you to do to the patient.
Correct, right.
Okay, so trauma nurses is really not a good paradigm for this case. Would you agree?
The employment relationship, I mean, the broker, the employment broker and trauma nurses, their job was to get the work and send nurses there. What happened beyond that was not in the scope of their business model. So in that same fashion, we would get the contracts, figure out what needed to be done, and then we would send the subs out to actually to do the work.
But you also provided all of the materials, which is not quite the case when you're dealing with trauma nurses.
True. Yes, we did. I mean, that's in the record. We did supply the drywall, I think some of the bead boards on the side, some of the mud, that kind of thing. But the drywallers themselves provided scaffolding, which is expensive, and they provided their own tools, everything else that they would need for that job, the ladders, their transportation to each site was all done by the subs, and their insurance. They provided their own insurance.
You mentioned in your opening statement that the basically the business model, that wasn't your term, but the business model that is in residential construction in New Jersey would be profoundly changed if this court were to rule that the first prong of B is satisfied when a drywall company hires a contractor employer, and that's, and B is immediately, they can't meet under those circumstances.
Actually, the second part.
That's your second part of B, and on places of business. Why would that impact the broader relationships in the construction industry?
Because a general contractor who contracts with an owner, say somebody buys a property and wants to construct a new house, on, or you know, demolish the old one, construct a new house. So that owner will contract with a general contractor or a builder draw up the plans, figure out who needs to come in at one point to do, you know, to frame the house, to, you know, put the insulation in, plumbing, electric, all of that, drywall, painting, cabinets. So that general contractor gets the general contract and then subs all of those individual components out for that particular house. Now that general contractor, let's say it's on Maple Street, that contractor might also have another house being built on Ocean Avenue, and then maybe a third one on Atlantic Avenue. So that general contractor has several different projects that they're working on. And so if each one of those projects is considered to be that general contractor's place of business, then all of those subs.
Why isn't employees. The general contractor okay under the AB under B, based on the first part of of B?
My understanding of the first part of B would be a situation like, for example, a Target store is in the business of selling merchandise. And they subcontract out another company who to come in and do custodial work. That was my understanding of what part B, the first part, was.
So what's your understanding of that? What I'm really asking about is what impact would a ruling by this court on B have on construction generally in New Jersey? So if a general contractor who's not a plumbing specialist but is in the construction business hires a plumber, an electrician, a drywall person, et cetera, is the first part of B satisfied because everybody is engaged in the in construction?
Yes, yes, because you're right. That is the business there is to build the house or the building, whatever.
So you're saying, just let me continue and so I understand what you're saying. You're saying because the first part of B is can't be met essentially by a general contractor hiring subs, that if this court were to rule that the places of business extends into all houses that are being built by the general, the general can no longer hire an independent contractor
right.
to do residential construction in New Jersey.
It would not be able to satisfy that second part of B because every place where they are building houses would then all of a sudden become their place of business and they would be forced to consider those subs as employees.
Let me first ask a question. Does your client have a physical site?
So we do have an address. And it's in Villis, I think if I'm saying that correctly, in Cape May County. That's the mailing address. That's where the business address.
Is that all we have?
That is all we
have.
Okay,
so that could be a mailbox address for all we know.
Or it could be a residence. They have a home office.
Okay, but we don't know. And the burden is on you to present evidence that these are not employees. These are contractors. Mm-hmm. Correct? Independent contractors.
Correct.
Now, all right. This general. Well, let me ask you this question on the record. Before 2013, were you giving W-2s to your people?
That is not on the record overall, but we do have evidence that at least one person did have a W-2 at some point.
What do you mean it's not on?
It did not come up whether we had W-2 employees prior to 2013
but
or not.
You're saying there is like evidence of record of one W-2?
There was that one individual that I referenced, Mr. Sarah, who was an employee and then wanted to start his own company.
This is pre or post 2013?
Off the top of my head, I don't recall.
So can you look at this from the perspective of an individual who installs drywall and performs job after job, week after week, only at a work site for East Bay? And if East Bay said, thanks, we don't need your help anymore, they had no other business, no other record, it would be difficult for them to survive. Should they be considered an employee? And how would East Bay treat them?
So these are drywall installers in the construction industry.
And they have a single person LLC, each one of them.
Right. So we give them a contract. Each contract is per job. So it would be per house. So let's say it takes anywhere between a couple of days and a couple of weeks to perform whatever drywalling installation is necessary. They would finish that job. They would get paid. Then they could do anything.
They don't. Under the hypothetical that I'm asking you to address, mm-hmm. they are, for all practical purposes, essentially working full-time for one entity, and that's East Bay. Are they an employee or an independent contractor?
If they worked from January to December only for us?
They did job after job, week after week, but only for you. An LLC, each time.
I think that would be, it's hard to tell because they would have the possibility of working for somebody else. But if they in fact only worked for us that entire year, then it would be hard to satisfy prong C.
C, we're talking about, right?
Yes.
What I'm trying to figure out is, imagine this.
But you have to satisfy all three prongs.
Actually, can I add one thing to what I just said? It would be hard to satisfy part C, but I don't think impossible, because if the sub chose to only work for us, and we, under for every job, we contacted them and said, can you do another one? Or and they had to evaluate and see what their, you know, what where the location was, what it involved. I think that if it's still the subcontractor's choice ultimately, and so you lose some of that master-servant relationship.
I want to follow up on the chief's question. And imagine that the drywall subcontractor takes some people out of a union hall. Okay, and also from time to time takes people who are in a one-person LLC. The people taken out of the union hall, would you consider those to be independent contractors?
The individuals?
Yeah, they're hired from a union hall to install the drywalls, and they don't work 52 days a week. 52 weeks a year. 52 weeks a year. Okay, they just work. They work. I don't know. They may work 6 or 7 weeks. Would the person be an employee or an independent contractor?
Part of it would depend on what the individual is asking. If they said, I'm not.
Ask
I don't have my own business.
He goes. Does 7 weeks at your site and 7 weeks at another site. Independent contractor?
I think it could be either. Assuming that you could give a 1099 to an individual for 8 weeks worth of work.
It was my understanding from your perspective, your client's perspective, that really only C was at issue. Because if B's at issue here, then no residential construction sub would ever satisfy B, correct?
Correct. Okay. And there is also, I don't know if it's carpet remnants or another opinion, but if C is satisfied, then A and B should be not quite so mechanically applied. That, you know, as long as there's that independence of the subcontractor, that A and B is
understood. But if we accept your adversary's position, no subcontractor in a residential construction site would ever satisfy B. We'd never get to C in any of those cases.
Correct.
C is more, would you say that C is more individualized and fact-specific than B in terms of the ramifications to construction generally?
I would recommend starting with the C analysis, actually, because again, if the sub is clearly independent and can survive on its own without that contractual relationship with the contractor, with East Bay, then it's easier to conceptualize what B would be like.
I assume that you have a breadth of experience with residential construction beyond this one drywall client whom you're representing today. Mm-hmm. Do you see a ruling by this court that the second part of B is satisfied because of work in a residential location as profoundly disruptive to New Jersey residential construction and the way it's economically set up?
Yes, and particularly because it's all on all fours with carpet remnants, you know, where they found that going into the house and installing the carpet was not, it did not satisfy Part B.
Counsel, can I ask you, isn't this really a false dilemma? Because B can be satisfied with either one. You don't have to satisfy both. You're exclusively in that field, or you can show that. So you don't have to worry about the second part. You, under your understanding, you met the first part, because that's what you do. You're a subcontractor. You do construction. You do drywall. You're a subcontractor. But besides bringing all the material, explaining what the job is involved, supervising, make sure that the job is conforming to the contractual obligations that your client has. Other than that, that's your job, that's your client's business. Not actually doing drywall, is procuring people that can do drywall. And you think that qualifies, that enables a whole host of people who actually do drywall to have no protection for unemployment or other benefits that the public policy underlying this statute was intended to address. Not whether it has a catastrophic outcome to the industry, but whether the people who actually do the work can be compensated when they're unemployed. So I don't understand what the problem is with B here. Can you help me out? Because you're already satisfied. B is disjunctive.
Correct. And our argument is that we satisfy that it's the second part.
Yeah. Let me understand, because it's my questionnaire, I think, that may have created some confusion. I thought you said that no general contractor, I know you can't speak for everybody, but the normal general contractor relationship, the first part of B can't be satisfied. And it's the second part of B that the general contractor in a normal residential construction has to rely on in order to meet B.
Right.
That's what you said. Yeah. You didn't say you're home free on the first part. I thought it was the opposite.
Yeah, correct. Because we're talking about constructing houses.
Yeah.
That would include the whole, you know, from soup to nuts, basically. But yeah, the general contractor would be impossible for them or any other person hiring subs in construction where you're sending your workers out to install anything.
You're saying that the general contractor is in the usual course of business is going to be building houses, and all of those subs are going to be in the same business of some component of building, and that a general contractor in a residential construction can't meet the first part of B. So if they're going to meet B, they've got to be relying on that place of business carpet remnant concept.
Correct.
Okay, so that clarifies it.
Yes. Thank you.
So if they don't meet B, that's the end of the story. Even though I thought you made a very reasonable point earlier that C should be driving the analysis.
That is true.
Yeah.
So
how do you reconcile those two?
Well, I would start with C to look to see if if the relationship is indeed independent. Because I think that ultimately that is what we're talking about.
But let's put B to one side for a second.
Okay.
In analyzing C, should the carpet remnant factors be looked at? And how would that be done in practice?
I think that they should be considered, again, as sort of guidance. I don't think that it's a checklist that needs to be checked.
But in a case like this, where the industries have many similarities, please.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I do think that they should be examined and on balance, assessed reasonably to determine whether the subcontractor is indeed independent or if that termination of that relationship would result with the workers joining the ranks of the employed, unemployed.
You heard the earlier questions about whether an employer is best situated to be able to present evidence on those factors.
Yes.
How do you respond to them?
Yes, and we did. I mean, we are a two-member entity. It's a father and son business. We don't have clients control or, a full-time person to go and check to verify all of this. We rely on not only the documents presented by the subcontractors, but also on our understanding of the industry, our discussions with other contractors, other employers, other subcontractors.
How is information about the respective volume of business, the number of customers presented on the record? Do you have access to that?
From the record?
How does that information come out altogether? Can you present it?
Honestly,
it seems relevant.
We don't, other than having a conversation with one of the subs or a conversation with another contractor or another builder, I don't know how we could say conclusively, yes, this person was working for us and working for you know, Johnny's Construction and Leeds Builders. I mean, we don't have that ability. So we have to rely on the evidence that we would have in this case, in 2013, when we entered into a contract with Kozlaw Drywall. And they gave us the certificate of insurance. And they could prove that they actually had gone to register something.
You have to rely on them with one exception. You know how much work they've done for you throughout the entirety of the year.
We do know, yes. We do have that. And that is actually in the record based on the auditor's report, at least the numbers. It's not necessarily ours, but we do have, you know, the what the taxable income was.
Are you asking us to disavow the carpet remnant factors for C? The chief was going over some of them. The burden's on you. In this case, the commissioner found you had the burden. There was a lack of evidence satisfying the factors in five. In fact, the commissioner found that the ALJ had not analyzed them. Why don't you fail just on that basis? Given agency deference, we defer to findings of the commissioner that are supported by sufficient credible evidence in the record, and they're saying, well, what have you presented on C with respect to duration and strength of the subcontractor's business, the number of his customers, number of his employees, resource, all of the factors in corporate remnant. Go ahead.
Because the reality is that a small business like us, we couldn't have given much more than what we gave by way of testimony.
My question is, are you saying that the carpet remnant factors are just not relevant? Are you asking us to, in this case, disavow them and consider some other paradigm?
I wouldn't say that we would disavow them because they are helpful guidance. But what would be ideal is, I think Justice Patterson mentioned, that if we could get some regulations, that would really be helpful. Although I know, you know, we're limited here in what this court can do. But that's where I think the resolution would be best situated.
Was there any evidence presented on the duration and strength of the subcontractor's business? Did you present any evidence about that?
What we said was we hired them per job, and we would ask them first if they were available. That was kind of a general practice.
What incentive would a subcontractor, if you want to call them that, someone that your client hired, what incentive would they have as a matter of small businesses in a competitive market to saying, yeah, let me sit down with you and I'll explain, I'm working on this other house and here's what they're paying me for that. And I'm working next week, I'm hoping to work on this. I mean, there's an element of people aren't going to hand over all that information simply to be helpful in a DOL proceeding, are they? As a realistically?
Realistically, no. I mean, I think that if somebody, you know, 4 or 5 years later, if they had to circle back to 2013 to say, oh, yes, I remember I was working for East Bay and I was working for Leeds Builders and I was working for this. I mean, I think it would be hard to even find that.
And a small business that doesn't have much work and is really relying on East Bay probably doesn't want to tell East Bay, you're all I got. I'm just as a matter of.
I think, again, it depends. I mean, it could go both ways, because if the sub is so busy that they're working for so many other people, that could also indicate that they're really good. And so, especially if they hadn't worked for East Bay before, and if East Bay had talked to those other builders and found out that those, you know, this particular sub is really skilled, then, you know, that could, you know, it could sweeten the deal for East Bay to try to get them on board.
You have more that you'd like to present, Ms. Barr?
I do not, unless there are any more other questions.
I don't think so.